She was plucked from almost obscurity and became one of the most famous people in the world. And that really does change a person.
A new look at Sarah Palin's rise as a political star. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 3rd of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Obama administration prepares for tribal meetings in Washington.
The best way to address the past is to honor treaty promises and respect sovereignty.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
The Parnell administration says the state's gas line project is working as well as, or better than, intended. A report sent to legislators over the weekend and made public this morning says the state licensee, TransCanada, and ExxonMobil are on target to complete the next major step in the process by this summer. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The plan the state is following under the AGEA guidelines is ahead of schedule and ahead of spending projections. And the report says that spending is generating data. The administration's gas line team has a positive take on the long-term prospects for marketing natural gas from the North Slope. Gas line coordinator Mark Myers reminded reporters that Alaska already has a significant investment in the project.
We committed $500 million of state money to this project. We committed with state-specific goals and challenges for the licensee to meet. We knew when it was passed, when it was ratified, when the legislature approved the license, we were on a 10-year journey. It takes 10 years to build a project like this and get the first gas.
Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin focused on the parts of the report referring to the long-term prospects for Alaska gas in North American markets. He said the AGEA project is not being driven by short-term economic conditions, and he sees natural gas as the key to the state's revenue future. Critics, most notably in recent weeks, former Governor Frank Murkowski, say that the state's long-term revenue future lies not in gas, but in the increased production of oil on the North Slope, saying the state needs to put more emphasis on production and increasing the load on the Trans-Alaska pipeline to Valdez. But Galvin disagrees.
The large prospects for production from the North Slope are going to be found on federal land and in federal water, where the state's revenue is not as strong. And so, again, our focus on expanding the level of production of oil on the North Slope is not changing.
And Mark Myers says gas production is essential to oil production. Together, they'll increase revenue more for each type of resource. He describes a synergy. Much of the early gas production will come from oil fields, and having available a gas delivery system will open a new market to encourage production of both oil and gas.
You look at the crude oil infrastructure, you look at the 20 billion barrels or so of heavy oil up there. Not all of it's going to be economically recoverable by any stretch of the imagination, but the longer the field infrastructure can produce, the longer time we have to produce those resources, the longer we have to keep tap throughput at significant levels to be economic. Gas helps immensely with that.
The first open season for the state-sanctioned gas line project is scheduled to run from May 1st to July 31st. That'll be another milestone, giving developers a look at how the project stacks up against other possible sources of gas and providing a base for further negotiations. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A new book out today takes a look at the transformation of Sarah Palin last year from governor of an isolated state to the national spotlight as John McCain's running mate. It also speculates on her political future and predicts she will run for presidency in 2012. The book is called Sarah from Alaska, The Sudden Rise and Brutal Education of a New Conservative Superstar. It is written by two reporters who followed Palin on the campaign trail. Co-author Shoshana Walsh is a former reporter for Fox News. She says at the beginning of the campaign, Palin was willing to go along with McCain's strategy, but she quickly started challenging his plan for winning the election.
When it came to the issue of Michigan, she wanted to keep fighting there. Even when the data said, no, it's not going to work, when the emails we got said that it's a cheap drive, I'll pay for the gas. And obviously this is well below her pay grade as the number two on the ticket. But even during the beginning, when she was first picked, she really wanted to come back and talk to the press. She thought she could woo the press, as she really did at the beginning of her governorship up in Alaska. So she felt that she was mishandled and wanted to act out more on her own. Another big issue that you saw that with is that Jeremiah Wright, she desperately wanted to bring that up. She thought it was more relevant than Ayers. And that one night when they were toasting her debate performance, she said an offhand joking comment, but it was quite prescient, saying, I just don't want to go back to Alaska. And that why she wanted to take the gloves off and go after Wright. But John McCain had said that that is not an issue that he wanted to be associated with, and that the campaign was not going to bring it up. And McCain staffers started to think of her, and she has now grabbed that phrase for her own, but going rogue.
You begin the book with a look at election night and the concession speech that Palin wanted to make but famously did not give. Explain what happened and why you think it was such an important moment for Sarah Palin.
Well, she really did desperately want to speak. She wanted to grab that spotlight one last time, but also the speech was quite deferential to John McCain, somebody that she did work hard to try to elect. And at the end, after John McCain leaves the hotel, she wants to go up on the stage to take pictures with her family. And the McCain staffers were so scared that she was going to go up there and give her speech and undermine what they saw as undermining John McCain one more time, that they actually turned the lights off, cut the sound on her. And, it was already dark out. She didn't notice, really, but just that act. I mean, this is their candidate that they chose.
What were the most striking things that you discovered as you were researching the book?
Well, one of the revelations that I thought was particularly interesting is it was such a media firestorm when it came out how much money was spent on the clothes. And we spoke with her stylist exclusively. And in this one instance, it really wasn't her fault. And she, was looking at price tags and saying, hey, this is too expensive. The stylist, Lisa Klein, and one of Palin's assistants were actually taking off the price tags because so that she wouldn't be so upset about it and just put it on and go out there and speak. And so that was, I think, one revelation was really interesting.
The book also describes a lot of ruthless moves that Palin has made during her political career, often quickly disposing of people who had helped her greatly in the past. But as you write, she can also be very warm and generous. Did you manage to untangle or shed light on this contradiction in her style?
She really expects loyalty from everyone around her, but she doesn't always give that back. You saw with different instances in Alaska. I think one of the most interesting stories in the book is the John Bitney story. And this is somebody that really can credit making Sarah Palin who she is and being such an integral part of winning the governorship. And he gets involved in a personal issue and is really just tossed aside.
You write that despite her resignation, it seems clear to you that Palin still wants to be president of the United States. What gives you this impression?
I don't think that she's done anything to say otherwise. I mean, right when she came home from the campaign, she was interviewed, and most national politicians will, if somebody says, are you going to run again, they'll be quite coy about it. And she did not. She said that if any doors are open in 2012, I'm going to crash right through them. And the opposite of coy. And whether it's interjecting in the New York 23 congressional race or getting involved in the healthcare debate. She also has a massive base with conservatives, and wherever she goes, she's mobbed by thousands of screaming fans, unlike really any politician in America, I guess, besides Barack Obama.
In your conversations with her, did you tell her ever that a book was maybe a possibility? And if so, how did she react to that?
I did. When we decided to put the book together, I was here in New York City, and I called Chris Perry, her closest aide and friend, and they happened to be together. They were about to board a plane, and they were very excited about the book, and Governor Palin got on the phone, was joking around, and Chris Perry said, you know, come to Alaska, and offer an open invitation for Scott and I to come. Days before we were to leave, her political spokesperson, Meg Stapleton, said that that wasn't going to happen.
And why did that change, do you think? Why was she not allowed then to meet with you?
It could have been that she had signed a book deal, or it could be that she realized that it wasn't just going to be a one-sided story, that we were really there to find both sides, to speak to friends, family, but also enemies, foes, and both sides.
Shoshana Walsh is co-author of the new book, Sarah from Alaska. A senior Coast Guard official in Anchorage was charged today with multiple offenses, including sodomy, indecent acts, and conduct unbecoming an officer and gentleman. Captain Mark Hamilton is accused of 31 violations. The 7-page charging document details multiple sexual relationships with subordinates, describes Hamilton engaging in sexual conduct while on active duty, and storing explicit material on his government laptop. The alleged violations date back to 2006 and also include fraud, adultery, indecent language, and soliciting another to commit an offense. Lieutenant Eric Egan says today's charges mark the transition from a preliminary investigation to a formal one.
An investigating officer will hear the charges and evidence against Captain Hamilton and make a determination and a recommendation to Rear Admiral Colvin, who will then make the final decision on whether we go forward with a court-martial or some other disciplinary action or dropping the charges altogether.
Egan says he can't talk about the charges against Hamilton because the investigation is ongoing. A date for the hearing has not been set. Hamilton was removed in May from his duties as the Coast Guard's commander for the Anchorage sector, but he still works for the Coast Guard in Anchorage. He began the position in August 2008 and previously served as deputy commander for Coast Guard operations in the Los Angeles area. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a backlash against Catholic Church abuse settlements.
It was fine until it says we've got to take the bank accounts of the poor parishes and the impoverished communities.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. And by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Leaders of Alaska tribes and corporations are gathering in Washington to meet with President Obama at what's being billed as a historic event. APRN's Libby Casey reports that the White House is gearing up for Thursday's Tribal Nations Conference.
Leaders from all federally recognized tribes are invited to this week's conference, and so many are coming that the event is too big for the White House. So the Interior Department will host Thursday's event. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar says the Obama administration wants the message out that consultation with tribes is meaningful, not just lip service.
Thursday's Tribal Nations will be the first meeting of its kind for a very long time with federally recognized tribes. There has not been such a meeting now for over 15 years. All 564 federally recognized tribes will have the opportunity to interact directly with President Obama and with representatives from the highest levels of his administration.
The president's advisor on Native American issues, Kim Teehee, says even the last major White House meeting 15 years ago didn't have this much high-level attention. Cabinet secretaries of education, energy, commerce, health, and other departments will be there. Teehee says it's basically the biggest conference the Obama administration has hosted so far for any group.
Certainly, they didn't have the level of agency participation and cabinet participation and senior staff participating either And so, I mean, it's unprecedented, I think, for a single conference this year to have had so many agency cabinet officials and senior officials present.
Members of the Obama administration acknowledged Tuesday in a teleconference with reporters that any such gathering can't ignore past grievances by the federal government toward tribes. Teehee says keeping in mind devastating history can help prevent future problems.
One of the things that is clear on our mind is the fact that without consultation, without collaboration, the kinds of policies that can start from the federal government, you have the assimilation policies, the allotment policies, the termination policies, and only in the era of self-determination the tribes begin to be able to pursue self-determination, to be able to provide economic development opportunities for themselves, and to be able to make decisions for themselves.
Bureau of Indian Affairs head Larry Echohawk will also be at this week's meeting. He says one way to heal and move forward is to show respect for tribes in current policy.
The best way to address the past is to honor treaty promises and respect sovereignty. And that's what this White House conference is all about, nation to nation, dialogue, communication, and consultation to improve the quality of life for Native Americans. And I'm just honored to be a participant in it.
Interior Secretary Salazar calls the dialogue taking place between tribes and the Obama administration momentous, but he also warns there's no easy fix.
We don't expect and will not be at a point where Thursday President Obama and Indian leadership from around the country can wave a magic wand and say we've solved these problems. But they are issues which we will identify, and we will put together teams to work on these issues so that when all is said and done, we will have made a difference in Indian country.
Among the Alaskans going to this week's meeting is NANA Regional Corporation President Marie Green from Kotzebue. Green says she hopes to see President Obama reach out and also listen. She says subsistence will be a top issue for her, a topic that dominated last month's Alaska Federation of Natives convention.
Like the others traveling down from Alaska, I hope that we'll have the opportunity to raise our concerns like we have just recently with the Department of Interior, but having the president become aware of what those concerns are.
Green will be one of 10 heads of Alaska Native corporations expected to attend this week, and she hopes they're able to talk about the Small Business Administration's 8A program, which gives the corporations advantages getting government contracts. It's recently come under fire in the U.S. Senate. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Older Sea Alaska shareholders have until November 20th to sign up for larger dividends. It's the first time the regional Native corporation is making an extra payment to elders, but it's not the first corporation to do so. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Sea Alaska shareholders already get a $2,000 check when they turn 65. It's from an elders trust established in the early 1990s. That came after a lobbying effort to modify the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which created the corporations. Rosita Worrell is Sea Alaska's board vice chairwoman.
We wanted to be able to give them special benefits, but we learned enough about corporations and realized that we could not give unequal distributions to special classes of shareholders. So at that point in time, in the mid-80s, we went back to Congress and we secured that right to give special benefits to special classes of shareholders, such as elders.
Sea Alaska later decided to do more for seniors. The board of directors proposed giving them an extra 100 shares of stock when they turned 65. That happened the same time the corporation also campaigned to give shareholders' descendants 100 shares. Worrell says that campaign raised concerns among some older members.
When we were actually doing the work, we noticed that our elders seemed to be quiet. And a concern they had was, the dilution of stock. We knew that our elders lived on fixed incomes. So we just said we've got to do this for our elders.
The extra stock for seniors plan went before shareholders in 2007, but it failed to gain a majority of all possible ballots as required by corporate law. Officials went back to Washington and got Congress to change that to a majority of ballots cast, an easier goal. And earlier this year, the elders' dividend passed. Sea Alaska estimates about 2,200 shareholders are currently eligible, with more to come as they turn 65.
They will be getting money from our permanent fund and our operations, the profits from those. And it will be life estate stock. They have them as long as the elder, you know, is here.
The extra elder shares cannot be voted during corporate elections, and their dividends do not include natural resource revenues, which have made up much of recent payments. That means this first elder's distribution, to be sent out in early December, will total $135 per person. That's in addition to regular corporate dividends, about $1,230 for urban and at-large members, and about $135 for village shareholders and descendants. Sea Alaska is one of several Alaska Native corporations making extra payments to older shareholders, but they don't all do it the same way. Anchorage-based Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, for example, issues fixed $450 quarterly payments. University of Alaska professor Edgar Blatchford, a former Chugach CEO, says not all corporations can afford such programs.
It goes back to profitability. It goes back to the small base of shareholders that Chugach Alaska has. And so you don't need to make as much money, say, as a large corporation such as Doyon or Sea Alaska or Chelicity, where they have thousands and thousands of shareholders. You have to make one heck of a lot of money in order to have any sort of a distribution.
Sea Alaska's first elders' dividends will be issued around December 4th. To get the payment, eligible shareholders must opt in by returning a card sent by the corporation by the November 20th deadline. Those signing up after that date will be eligible for later distributions. In Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
This flu season, every Alaskan should roll up their sleeves and fight the flu by making plans to get both the swine flu and regular seasonal flu vaccines. In the meantime, you can fight the flu by regularly disinfecting hard surfaces, avoid touching your mouth, nose, and eyes, and wear a face mask if you are sick and in close contact with others. For more information on how to fight the flu, go to pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A longtime member of the Catholic Church in Emonic is waging a letter campaign to try to protect rural parishes from sexual abuse lawsuits. 64-year-old Nick Tucker is distributing a letter to media outlets statewide saying rural parishes are being unfairly targeted by 300 people who claim abuse by parish clergy in past decades. Tucker says legal action should target the diocese, not individual rural churches.
Abuse victims' lawsuits are fine, they're legitimate and are overdue. However, I think the process has left its track. It was fine until it says we've got to take the bank accounts of the poor parishes and the impoverished communities and their properties. That's where it became a social village issue.
Tucker says the village churches do a lot of good, and taking their money and property would be detrimental to the small, poor communities they serve. The bishop of Northern Alaska, who oversees the rural parishes, is in bankruptcy due to abuse lawsuits. The bishop's property and cash are being contested in court to determine what should go into a compensation fund for victims. The church claims rural parishes' property and finances are separate and therefore protected, while victims claim the community church assets should be liquidated. Ken Rosa, who represents many of the abuse victims, says the goal isn't to cripple rural parishes.
The creditors committee is made up of individuals who live in the villages, and many of them attend these churches. They're not trying to shut down the Bush churches. They're not trying to shut down the church in Emonic or Luckanuck or Hooper Bay. That's not their plan at all. They're simply trying to make sure that the bishop gives a fair amount of money to the victims and that he doesn't hide assets.
Rosa says even if village savings and real estate aren't used to pay abuse victims directly, the assets could be used to leverage loans to do so. The bishop recently offered an updated $11 million compensation plan that includes $500,000 in village parish funds in exchange for legal protection for the rural churches. Claimants say that's not enough and want access to trust accounts set up to hold parish assets. A man in the lower Yukon village of Kotlik died when his snow machine broke through ice on the river, but not before he saved his son's life. Shane Iverson from member station KYUK in Bethel reports.
Michael Hunt Jr., age 41, was riding a snow machine with his 14-year-old son when the ice gave way underneath them, submerging the two in frigid waters. Fellow Kotlik resident Alec Lichty came down the trail behind them and saw their heads above the ice. Lichty says he raced to them and started doing what he could to save them.
Right when I reached the other end of the river, I had a twine on the back end of my snow machine, and I started untwining it.
Lichty thinks they had been in the water for several minutes by the time he arrived. As he began to assist, he saw the father, Michael, push his son up and onto a floating chunk of ice.
I realized Michael was trying to save his son. Right after he got on top of that chunk of ice, that's when he took his last breath and went under.
Lichty watched helplessly and then worked quickly to save the boy.
And I had a different focus just to save that boy because I think he wanted his son to be saved more.
Another traveler had arrived and Lichty instructed him to find a branch to tie onto the twine. In the meantime, Lichty crawled on his stomach to see if he could get close enough to assist the floating boy, but the fractured ice wouldn't support his weight.
And I almost fell to myself. My arms went through the ice, and I was able to back up and get my momentum back.
By then, the other person had returned with a small branch. Lichty tied it to the twine and then threw it to the floating boy, who was able to grab it and hold on while the two rescuers towed him to safety. Lichty says the boy was in shock and freezing. The other traveler took him home and put out an emergency call to the village over VHF radio. Kotlik residents towed boats to the scene to begin searching for Hunt. They found him an hour and 15 minutes later and took him to the village clinic where he was warmed and later pronounced dead. The trail they were using connects the main village of Kotlik to homes on a nearby island across the river. The trail had been used several times in the last few days, but Lichty says that the ice wasn't strong enough to hold the father and son on the same snow machine. Alaska State Troopers say the ice was thick enough for travel in much of that area. The body of Michael Hunt Jr. has been returned to his family. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Yesterday, the Anchorage School District held the first of its school site vaccination clinics. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Mark Mew is Director of Security and Emergency Preparedness for the Anchorage School District. He says yesterday's first round of elementary school H1N1 vaccination clinics featured lower than expected participation.
We ran about 40% of the student population. We don't know if that's going to hold or not. That's a little less than what our predictions were, but it did give us a little extra vaccine that we may need because things are looking pretty tight next week.
Last week, the district predicted about 65% participation. The elementary schools are first because children 9 years old and younger require two doses. This is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.